Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to be talking to the winners of the Writers of the Future, Eric and Darcy Stone. And they also, Darcy was first place this year. Eric was second place in 2005. They both have a lot of writing, according to their stuff, so we have a lot to talk about. Hi, guys. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with how you started writing, because we have a lot of writers that listen to the show. Did you both write as children, or did you develop it later in school? How did it all start?
For me, it started with I just read a lot as a kid. And one of the things I read when I was a teenager was a book called The Early Asimov by Isaac Asimov. And in between the short stories that were in there, he talked about his life as a writer. And that was the first time I thought, oh, it would be kind of cool to be a writer. I did some creative writing in college and stuff. And then I submitted my best short story to a couple of places, and it got rejected, and I gave up writing for 10 years. I don't recommend that to anyone out there who wants to be a writer. Eventually, I got back into writing and started submitting places, and my first published story was with the Writers of the Future contest as a published finalist, and then I went on to take second place in a quarter in the Writers of the Future contest, and basically I've had 50 or more than 50 short stories published since then. That was kind of the start of my writing career, and I had a novel come out from Bain Books. And now Darcy can tell how she got into the writing.
So I tell a lot of people that I married into the world of writing when I married Eric. I had toyed a little bit with writing in junior high and high school. I would kind of plot out book ideas in my mind, but I had never really sat down and actually written anything. And then when I was dating Eric, I attended his writing group with him, and I thought, you know what, this would be kind of fun. I'll give it a try. I can do this. And so then I started working on a story that I was, in my mind, I just thought it was a practice story to kind of learn the craft. And that's the story that I ended up submitting to Writers of the Future. And I got first place. So that was exciting. And now I'm working on turning that story into a full-length novel.
That's always a challenge to expand any kind of short story into anything. Are you guys going to be working together as well as partners on a book?
So far, we've helped critique each other's writing. We haven't actually worked on any joint projects, but, I mean, anything's possible, I guess.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it depends on the people, too, because you guys might have styles that are completely different, and that may not work together. Just because you're happily married doesn't mean you're going to be happily partnered as writers. It's not a given.
It's also it might be that our styles are in some ways too similar. We're both very scientifically oriented and stuff like that. And so often when you have collaborations, the two writers have different strengths. And so by combining together, they can do something better than either of them could produce alone. I'm not sure that Darcy and I particularly have different strengths. So I don't know that a combination between the two of us would be better than what we can do alone, other than critiquing and stuff like that.
Well, Darcy and I have something in common. We both have a degree in anthropology. Mine's in archaeology. the cultural art, anthropology, but we do you use your knowledge? I have a passion for history and archaeology and anthropology and all that. So sometimes it seeps into my stuff without my even realizing it. Do you have anything like that happening, Darcy?
Yeah, so I have traveled a lot, especially in Southeast Asia, and that shows up a lot in the story that I wrote. I am just fascinated by other cultures and how they perceive the world and how their worldview, you know, shapes their day-to-day behaviors. And I would like to think that that, you know, enriches my stories, giving the characters and their lives more depth. The main character in my story is a Vietnamese woman who gets to save the world because I was kind of tired of, you know, white American men always getting to save the day. So I thought I'd try something new.
I understand that. Eric, you said you have a scientific. I don't know exactly what is your background. Is it regular science? Is it astronomy? Is it astrophysics?
that's kind of interesting because I've had a bunch of stories published in Analog magazine, which is kind of the hard science fiction magazine, and I was having lunch with the editor at a convention, and he said, "So Eric, your background is in science, right?" And I said, "Yes, I have a degree in political science." I've read a lot of books about astrophysics and quantum mechanics and stuff like that. And so I have a very, very strong layman's knowledge of scientific concepts. And that really helps me to write my science fiction stories.
And I think it also helps that right now we're in the golden age of astronomy. We know more about our own solar system than we ever have in the history of humanity. So there's so much more to pluck. We know about Saturn's rings and the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, and that Pluto is not a dead planet, it's a living planet. We know so much more. Do you feel that that's going to help your future stories, because you know so much more through astronomy?
Well, in fact, I mean, we know a lot more about worlds outside our solar system.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, up until, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't even, you know, we hadn't even spotted any of these worlds outside our solar system. So yes, I think that really does help. I mean, in some ways, you know, it was so easy in the 1940s and 1950s to say, oh yes, well, there's, you know, life on Mars and life on Venus and we meet the Martians and things like that. So we're pretty sure that we're alone in our solar system. So for meeting aliens, we generally have to either assume that they're coming to us or that we're going outside our solar system at this point.
Yeah, well, and I think it's interesting that not only do we know more, but we also have access to so much information because of the internet.
No, I was just going to say the moon. Now I can't say it. Around Saturn, that the ice moon that has an ocean underneath it that spurts it out.
Europa.
Not Europa.
Europa.
It's not Europa. It's Euclidia, or something like that. It's not Europa. But they think there might be life there. It might be silicon based. Who knows? We may have Hordas as our neighbor.
As Darcy was pointing out, through the internet, we have access to a whole lot more information than we used to. I mean, Wikipedia is just an absolutely incredible source for finding out about all sorts of different topics.
Yeah, and then also just crowdsourcing. Like if you do have a question about how many years would it take in a spaceship to get to this star, you know, someone online is going to know an equation and they will calculate it for you. Like it's just amazing how much information we have at our fingertips.
That's true. And as writers, it's very interesting to look at your research history.
Yes, I often wonder, you know, sometimes a writer's internet search history can involve some very strange questions and themes. If anyone else is, you know, looking at that history, what they must be thinking.
Exactly.
Yes, I've just been working on a story that involved assassinations of U.S. presidents and stuff like that. So I've been doing a lot of, you know, Googling of, you know, assassination attempt and things like that. I hope I don't get a visit from the Secret Service.
Yeah. But and it's weird because I was I'm writing one of the novels that I'm working on is in Israel, and they have a different government structure, and even their police is different than most places. So I have this whole I have downloaded and looked at pretty much every government function and police function and Mossad and all that, and I'm like, I'm wondering if Mossad's going to come and visit me. Well, I mean, you have to do research, and that's the way you do it. But it's, you wonder, because, you know, the eyes are out there, what they're thinking is if they look at your history.
Yeah. Well, and I teach high school math and science is my day job. And so I love it in books when they get the science right. And they also tell a story that pulls the readers in, because anything that can get mainstream America or teenage America interested in science is a good thing. And so I love when we have some of these, like The Martian had so much good science in it, and it was such an exciting story. And
I think that's really cool. I saw this interview with Alan Alda. You know, he loves science. He's a big advocate for getting kids into science and trying to help scientists communicate better. And he has this really neat idea. And I watched a thing where he was talking about it, an interview where he was talking about it. And what he does is he uses his acting background to help scientists learn to communicate better through improvisation. I think it's really cool. So what he does is he films the scientist doing a lecture, and he says it's really cold and clear for them, but not for anybody else, and it's very difficult for the layman to understand. So he lets them do it, the whole thing, and then it's like five or six of them. And then he does his improvisation classes, and they all of a sudden aren't cold, so just in case science. They're having a blast learning how to improvise and to do the mirror exercise and to do the follow-along exercise and all this other stuff. And then he has them do it again, but the audience are all high school and college students. So not only are they doing it calmer, funner, more down-to-earth, in understandable English, but they're also inspiring these kids that are out in the audience at the same time. So he's improving the communication skills of the scientists, and the kids are watching the whole thing.
Yeah, it's win-win.
Yeah, isn't that the coolest idea? I hope that goes international, because it's just a great idea.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people that love math and science are not naturally good at, you know, teaching it or communicating it. And so that's kind of interesting that they're, you know, having the teachers do some drama and improv and stuff to improve those skills.
Because there was one lady, and this is really interesting, this one lady, she was really, well, what we do is we take these cells and we make sure that their photosynthesis is then after the improvisation, well, it's really cool what we're doing. Okay, we take these things, they're like cells, and they're like really elongated cells. And, I mean, she got really into it, but she was like enjoying herself, looking out at the audience, listening to their questions. I mean, it was like a different girl. It was cool. It was like a transformation. I was blown away by it. Isn't that cool?
I think they should try doing that for all school teachers.
Yeah. Yeah, they asked him, "What do you want to just keep this for science?" He goes, no, I want world domination. It's Alan Alda. I want world domination. I want everybody to do it. I mean, I can't do the wit and the twinkle in his eye and all that he did, but he did it with humor.
Yeah, no, I've been impressed because I have a degree in physics teaching, and yet I still have to work hard to keep up with my husband when he's writing some of his science fiction stories, because especially when it comes to astronomy and stuff, he knows so many things.
What do you think,
well,
Eric?
You know,
that's
if it came down to, you know, actually calculating scientific stuff, you know, with the physics of movement and things like that. But Darcy can run rings around me. But I read a lot more of the fringe, far out, speculative science that doesn't have too much application in people's daily lives. Because that's what interests me. I love New Scientist magazine because it does a very good job of taking some of the far out science ideas and presenting them in a way that a layperson like me can understand. That's where I often get some of my ideas, is reading these articles and saying, oh, you know, what if, and, you know, and figuring out how to apply that into a story setting.
Yeah, and I was on a panel recently that was called When Science is Stranger Than Fiction. And so we were talking a lot about, you know, there's so much going on in science right now that is absolutely bizarre. Like, you don't have to reach very far to find just really interesting ideas that are already happening. You know, like one of the ones we talked about was how they can use spider silk now to make shirts that are strong enough to stop bullets, but they weigh as much as a T-shirt, you know? Like, it's just, we live in a cool world.
We do. I mean, that's the good part of the Internet. That's the communication part, the positive communication part of the Internet. That's the bright side. That's the happy side. That's the part I like to concentrate on.
Yes.
I had a friend of mine send me, it's Enceladus, because it was driving me crazy, and she knows me, and she says, I know it's driving you crazy.
Yes.
The moon and the Saturn is Enceladus that you're trying to say the word. Because I hate when I can't pronounce or remember something I know. As you guys get older, you'll find that happens. Anyway, so I think that the communication and learning of new ideas and new frontiers in all the different fields are fascinating. That's happening now. In archaeology, they can map below the surface without breaking ground, so they don't have to keep doing holes. I was in archaeology. They don't have to keep doing holes. They can do Lyman and then find out where it is. And then when they do models, they can do amazing 3D models that are like projected in the classroom you could walk through. I never had that stuff.
Yeah, well, even with like virtual reality now, how you can, you know, put on the goggles and have a three-dimensional view of what you're looking at. I'm still waiting for a holodeck, you know. We're getting close.
That's what I want. I want a holodeck. I'll put it in the living room or in the bathroom. I don't care.
Yeah, no, from what I understand, they're actually using 3D models based on scans that were done for a video game to help with the restoration of Notre Dame Cathedral in France after the fire. It's amazing what, you know, the detail that these 3D models now have.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's a great idea because it's going to be hard enough for them to restructure that church.
Yeah, well, and they can do, you know, using 3D models that they've taken, they can then use virtual reality to do, like, operations on humans that have tumors and stuff because they just scan them and then interact with them, you know, using these 3D, you know, holographic images. And
well, actually, that was like
exciting
Star Trek. It's like Star Trek. I love that idea. The examination table where the part of the body that was the problem floated above, and then Dr. McCoy could say, okay, well, we have to do this, this, and this, and we take out a salt shaker and go, and it was all fixed.
Exactly.
And it's really funny because in some ways we are heading there, and in other ways we're not, but I think it's really cool in the ways we are heading there.
Yeah, well, and it is interesting to look at writing, like, speculative fiction and what they thought the future would be like and some of the things they got right and then some of the things they got wrong, you know, and how we're probably doing the same thing now as we imagine what we think our future is going to be like.
Yeah, talking with an editor once, we were talking about, you know, how you write science fiction set in the future. And basically he said, well, you know, one part of it is going to be, you know, just kind of linear improvement from now, you know, so you can take a trend right now and kind of figure out where it'll be in the future. And then one part of it will be interesting new combinations of technologies that we haven't, you know, yet combined, but you know, like holographic imaging and medical scanning and stuff like that. And then he says, and then there will be also some developments that we haven't even anticipated. I mean, you look at science fiction from the 1950s and 60s, and they started having computers, but the computers were always these giant, you know, computers that took up a whole building and, you know, everyone would ask something of that one big computer. The whole idea of miniature computers, you know, carrying them around, you know, in your pocket, that was just something they didn't anticipate.
I worked in my first job, office job, was in the 80s, and they still use those things. I remember I worked at a bank, and I had to do so. I was a file clerk, and I was upgraded to a different position, and they brought us to see the giant computer. This thing was like the size of the main office of the bank was like several blocks. It was a huge facility. The computer that ran it ran along the entire basement, and it was huge. I mean, it was floor-to-ceiling computers, and it was humongous. Now,
yeah, and I'm sure that its processing
like the
capabilities
size of
were
your...
minuscule.
What did you say, Darcy?
Yeah.
I said, and I'm sure that its processing capabilities were minuscule. Like, I'm sure that your iPhone today can do more than that computer could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, it was like a huge, it was, I forgot they call it DOS. I think it was DOS. And just to put addresses was hell. Because that was my first jobs was to put the address in. You had to use a code. And then you put the first name, and then another code, and you put the last name, and then another code for the middle name, and then another code for the street number, and then another code and the street name, I mean, it was, it took forever, and they go, hurry up, hurry up. And we're like looking at them because we're just learning. It
yeah.
was like, it was torture. It was horrible.
Yeah, no, it boggles my mind that the average cell phone these days has more processing power than the Apollo spaceships.
Yep. And Voyager has, is still being run on a computer from the early 70s. And it's
wow.
in another galaxy. Well, on the way to another galaxy. But that it's still being run by that old computer from when it was shot up.
Yeah, well, because if they tried to, you know, do anything, you know, run it on anything else, they would need somebody who understands the code that Voyager is running on, and all those people
are
probably long retired or dead.
No, actually, they're working on it. I saw a thing because they've been doing about space. And they're not that old. They were young when they were doing it. They're in their, like, 70s. Most of them are 60s or 70s. They're not that old. You can make them 90. No, but most of the people, yeah, have retired. But the main computer program people, they're still working it. I think it's fascinating. I'm a space nut. I mean, when I think it was John Glenn, when he went around the Earth, my dad took me out and my brother, who was a baby, to look at it, and I didn't understand it either because I was about four. And he says, look up. See that dot up there? That's our first man that is flying in actual space. And I want you to remember this. He tells the story over and over. I mean, he's gone now. He used to tell the story over and over again. And I looked at him one day. I think I was in my 30s. And he was telling my boyfriend at the time. I go, Dad, I don't really remember it from my own memory. Sorry.
My earliest memory is of an Apollo moon launch. My parents, had me watch the moon landing, but I do not remember it. But I do remember a moon launch, watching it on television. It's interesting how some of those things can stick in the memory and some of them don't. I think the rocket was, with all the fire and smoke and everything, was more spectacular than the moon landing from the perspective of the 2-year-old. So
2-year-old, I can't remember seeing the spaceship at 4. I don't know how you would even understand it at 2. But I remember actually the moon landing. I was, let's see, it was 69, right?
Yes.
Because 50 years. So I was 8 years old. So I remember it very well. And I was laying on the carpet with my feet up in the air, right in front of the TV, even though my mother was saying, get back, it's going to hurt your eyes. Watching and taking in everything and having a crush on Neil Armstrong. So that's my memory. Uh-huh. 8-year-old and I already had my first crush. we're coming to the part where I want you guys to tell about anything that's happening. Do you guys, are you working on books and do you have any kind of events coming up?
Well, as far as events, we are going to be at Salt Lake City FanX Comic Convention, which is coming up in a little over a week. It's a great convention, lots of celebrities there, as well as lots of authors and things. And we're going to be on at least one panel and doing some book signings there. So, yeah, and then as far as what we're working on, I've just been finishing up a short story for an anthology that's going to be coming out from Bain. I'm not 100% sure on the title. I think it's going to be Weird World War III. Just a bunch of short stories about different ways in which World War III might have happened, with a science fiction and fantasy twist on it. So, and
Darcy,
then I am my.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were done.
Yeah.
I was saying, Darcy.
Yeah. And then I am working on the sequel to my first novel. My first novel is called Unforgettable. It's available, you know, from Amazon and wherever. It came out from Bain Books. It's about a CIA agent who can't be remembered more than a minute after he's gone. And he has to save the world from a supercomputer that's going to try to take over everything. So I'm working on the sequel to that. It's rather slow going, but I am going to get it done eventually.
I'm sure you will. Darcy, what are you working on?
So I was the winner for Writers of the Future, Volume 34, and my winning story was called Mara's Shadow. And when I wrote that story, like, my original version was like 33,000 words long, and to enter the contest you have to get it below 17,000. So I had to cut the story in half.
Wow.
Which was a slow, painful process. But now I'm trying to go the other direction, so I'm trying to expand it back into a full-length novel. One of my favorite authors growing up was Michael Crichton. I just love how he blends science with thriller. And so I'm hoping to kind of, you know, imitate his style. It's a medical thriller. So I'm hoping to get that out. Both my husband and I right now have Hollywood options that we're working on. So you might see some of our, you know, stuff get turned into movies or TV shows. So, of course, you know, it's a long shot, but it's always fun. I've been working with, it's called the Hollywood Science Exchange, and it's pretty much people, and like, so a lot of scientists that are working with Hollywood to try to promote accurate science in Hollywood films. And then I'm halfway through a fantasy novel that I'm working on that is going to be targeted towards like middle school girls. So those are my projects. And I have two children that I'm trying to keep alive.
Well, they're your projects, too. okay, so now about the award, what was your experience with Writers of the Future like? I mean, I know it's got a long distance between you because Eric won in 2005 and you won in 2018. Eric, did the process change when Darcy did it?
I can tell you this. The competition got a lot tougher over the 14 years, you know, because the contest has been growing and growing and keeps getting more and more submissions. So for Darcy to take first place in her quarter was a real achievement, and then to win the grand prize was just a fantastic achievement. The award ceremonies have also gotten more spectacular over that time. But the contest, you know, as you can see, both Darcy and I started our careers with the contest. I really have to credit L. Ron Hubbard for being willing to, you know, pay it forward and create this contest to promote the careers of new writers. I think it's a fantastic contest, and I highly recommend it to people who are, just starting off on their writing careers and looking to break out.
Yeah, there's really nothing else out there like it. In order to enter the contest, you have to be a new author, so you can't already have an established career. And then if you win, they fly you out to LA for a week, and they have an amazing workshop where you get to meet other successful authors, and they give you, you know, tips of the trade. And then they, at the end of the week, they have this award ceremony that makes you feel like you're a movie star. So they really go out of their way to promote science fiction and fantasy, and to try to find new authors and encourage their careers. So it's a great
opportunity. With regard to the award ceremony, I won a Nebula Award back in 2011 for one of my novelettes, and the award ceremony for Writers of the Future is more spectacular than the Nebula ceremony. It's really kind of amazing.
Cool. We're coming to the end of the show. Do you guys have a website, and what are your handles on the different social media?
My website is at ericjamesstone.com. I really need to update it a little more often, but you can find me on Facebook and Twitter if you search for Eric James Stone.
Yeah, and if you search for Darcy Stone, you can find me on Facebook as well, and then I have a website, darcystone.com. Or no, is that it, Eric?
The Darcy.com.
The Darcy, yeah, the Darcy.com, PHEDARCI.
Okay, and are either of you on Twitter or Instagram or any of those other stuff?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as Eric James Stone.
So that way, if they want to, they can say hi, and let they go to the convention you guys are at, and then they can say hi then. So we're coming to the end. I want to thank you for coming on this show. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, no,
yes,
thanks for your time.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting.